podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Again, they've only got three forwards in the lineout, and it's been left to Chris Wyatt, and how well he did that again. Scott Quinnell, a bust by Scott Gibbs. Scott Gibbs is through. Scott Gibbs has scored. What an amazing...
Welcome to this week's Attacking Scrum podcast. It's been an interesting week of rugby. Me and Murph have been moaning for the last couple of weeks, particularly me, about the fact that all we've been talking about is COVID and the teams that have been stuck in South Africa. And I think we've had a pretty exciting weekend of rugby, if not perfect. So who better to bring in than the mighty Murph and Hello. Yes, and Yestin George? How are we doing, fellas?
Very well, thanks, Jared.
Good. Yeah, pretty good, mate. Cheers.
Good to have you with us. Yestin, I thought of you as I was watching the Cardiff game because it felt like a throwback to a previous era. It felt like it was a tour game. Do you know what I mean? It was like it was a combined East Wales 15 against South Africa, and South Africa had, you know, all full Springboks in the side. You knew that they were never going to win, but the sense of excitement and the noise of the crowd and everything about it. Honestly, I think the first 20 minutes of that game was the most enjoyable part of rugby I've seen all season.
It's rumbustuous was the atmosphere, wasn't it? It felt like I had to keep on pinching myself, saying, am I just getting carried away as an aging rugby fan watching some romantic doomed to failure exercise? But it was, you're absolutely right, never thought about it as a touring match, but it was exactly like that. Remarkable atmosphere created. So many questions, so many issues that it raises about, do we just love this kind of idea? Was it just a one-off if it happened every, you know, but the idea of players from the lower reaches being catapulted into the first team, the fact that they were, also the nature of the way that Cardiff decided to play, which was tap and go, chaos theory, the fact that you could see, you know, kids like Kabango on the pitch, you know, being 1 minute being smashed to the ground and the next minute getting up and darting through the, you know, the European champions, seeing players like Botham coming to age in 80 minutes of rugby, and seeing as if looking, you know, players with some experience suddenly becoming incredibly authoritative, supportive of each other. I mean, it really, every box in my kind of small, tiny world was ticked, really, right down to hymns and arias. It was just, the atmosphere was better there than it was when I went to see Wales play, you know, in the Principality.
So much of this is about the atmosphere. And I think that, I mean, the amount of apathy that regional rugby has been greeted with, rightly or wrongly, for the best part of 20 years, I think it just showed what rugby does mean in Wales. And I've no doubt that if, you know, if the Scarlets game had gone ahead in similar circumstances, we'd have seen something similar there as well. I think that kind of siege mentality was fantastic. Honestly, I think any one of those players should be able to walk in to any pub in Cardiff and just demand a free pint at any point. Or there is always one on me, for any one of those players. I was just so impressed with the intensity at which they played the game, you know. And to obviously you do have class on there. You've got Ellis Jenkins and Josh Adams and Halaholo and Thomas Williams, all had brilliant games, but you know, to be peppered with this kind of dirty dozen scenario of Dan Fish coming out of retirement for the third time this season, alongside alongside Jason Tovey and And, you know, I can't even remember his name, a school teacher coming off the bench at Hooker. It was just, and like you say, alongside youngsters like Beetham and Cabango, who have never been exposed to anything like that, but every single one of them standing up and just putting in a shift. And I even thought, you know, like Cabango got bumped, didn't he, for the try. But the read was spot on. You know, it was a massive overlap and fine. He stood, you know, he just went for it and the timing was perfect. But just that bit of, you know, that absolute power. There's no disgrace in getting bumped by Peter Aki. So I was so impressed with all of them. It's just to stand up in that degree of adversity after everything that's going on. Fair play. I think it does show what rugby means in Wales and what it means in Cardiff. So I was mighty impressed with every single one of them and the same goes for the coaching staff.
If DuPont hadn't played, they might have lost.
Do you know what?
It was almost
He was the
one that wasn't rattled, and Tamak was rattled. They were all rattled. They all made significant mistakes. And the amazing thing was to see scrum one. Oh yeah, okay, here we go. Scrum two. Okay, you know they're going to get smashed. Now you fully expected it to be scrum 13, and it was going to be carrying on. And guess what? Cardiff got themselves somehow clawed themselves back into having a half decent scrum as the game progressed because they'd rattle them in the other areas of the pitch. You know, a scrum doesn't function independently of the rest of the game. So because Cardiff had made them blow themselves out a little bit in the other areas of the game by keeping them moving. And it, like players like Yestin Harris, I thought was absolutely amazing. Seb Davis, again, he's proving himself to be a player who is prepared. He's, you know, much as I love the basketball playing antics of a second row or a back row forward, he showed the dog. He toughened, you know, he did all the nasty, dirty work. And that's why I can't speak highly enough about both them. Ellis Jenkins was great, as you would expect, really, to a certain extent, and Robinson you'd expect to be always game and competitive at the breakdown. I thought both of them was just different class.
If I'm honest, and I'm not sure I've ever said this on air, I was a little bit sceptical about the hype around both of them prior to yesterday. And I thought, you know, like, yeah, he's not, you know, he's good. I've seen some bright sparks, but I wasn't sure, you know, when he was in the Wales squad last autumn, whether that was all built a little bit off potential rather than kind of what we've seen today. And again, I'm sure Cardiff fans would slate me for saying that and saying I hadn't kind of watched him closely enough. But it was a mighty impressive performance. And again, he's a young guy who will get better.
And is he a number? Are we looking at another converted number eight like Wainwright? Maybe.
There is a shortage, so it's always possible. But they've allegedly signed Faletau, so
yeah.
He's played better in that. Go on, Jest.
No, I was just going to say it was just the fact that he, in a retreating scrum, that he could still make yards. That was the thing. It wasn't his all round game was tremendous, but yeah. There were a couple of scrums where he made all the difference with his pick and go.
Yeah, well, it's probably the best performance in an 8-shirt for Cardiff since Nick Williams left. Like the other boys they've tried since. That's a bit harsh on the likes of, say, Ben Murphy or whoever else has had a go. But that Ratty's is probably...
Lot,
yeah.
Ratty and Turnbull's put in a good few shifts, to be fair. But in that level of game, you know, against the quality of opposition that you're playing against, and from a guy that young, it was hugely impressive.
In a scrum in reverse as well. So the I agree with everything you've just said. The partisan nature of the crowd and it felt like a touring game in so much that it was like a festival atmosphere as well. And you know, every slight mistake was just pounced on by the crowd.
Beautiful, wasn't it?
Really felt retro to me. Yeah. All I was missing was like a brass band before kickoff, and you know, all the old cliches of old rugby. Like in Cardiff, I don't know if you two would remember, there was always a stink, a real strong stink of cigar smoke floating throughout the stand during a kickoff. That's one of the memories from when I was a kid.
That's the difference between watching rugby in Cardiff and Newport, though, isn't it? Because in Cardiff, it's cigars. And yeah. It's in Newport, it's Super Kings or dare I say it, Rothmans.
Yeah, or Rollies. well, there's an ex-Wanderers WhatsApp group of boys my age who played at the club, and Griff Reese, yeah, who coached the team yesterday, is a very good mate of mine, and he's on there, and everyone's congratulating him. And I wanted to congratulate him, but what I wanted to say was, 39-7, Toulouse could have easily scored that against the first choice team.
Absolutely.
You know, if it kind of had been full strength, they could have scored 40 points in that game. But I had to keep my mouth shut because Richard Hodges is also on that WhatsApp group, and I know he's in really tough situation with quarantine and different things, and he's got a young family and all that. So I'll have to wait till I see Griff and tell him privately that could have been the score. They probably would, if it was the first thing, they probably would have scored more points.
Yeah,
but conceding wise, defense wise, just it could have easily been 40 against that side.
But a massive hats off to Griff and the rest of the coaching team for getting them so pumped up for the game and refusing to roll over. With 70 minutes on the clock and the game has been dead and buried for 15 minutes, everyone wanted to keep playing to the absolute death. And the line speed was still as good as it could be with 70 minutes on the clock and players blown out their arse and semi-pros coming off the bench. I was just... I know there is a danger that we're over-romanticising it because that's what we do and we've got Yestin on the show. But it's... I just thought it was magnificent. It felt like it was... another analogy would be like the kind of... It was like, watching Henry Cooper take on Muhammad Ali, where you got to see some real spirit and kind of the early knockdown and that bit of hope of thinking, oh my God, is this incredible upset on the cards? But then you also had the out-and-out class of Dupont, which is just, and again, hats off to, it was just funny watching the Cardiff fans, when he put that cross-field kick in for the winger to score.
That was genius.
I can't remember which ringer it was, but like the low, it was a beauty. Like it's a kind of Tiger Woods golf shot. It was just incredible. That low trajectory on it, and Josh Adams' mouth was aghast. He was like,
"Yeah, that was funny, actually." Yeah.
But again, you could just you saw the Cardiff fans go, "Well, hats off, that's brilliant." It was just it's mad for a game that was never ever going to be the result was never in doubt to have produced that much joy. And reinvigorated my love of watching European rugby, and I just hope that the club kicks on and they have a really good they have a really good festive period apart from against the Dragons.
Yeah, there's a big feel good factor I think on the back of that game around the club. And also, how far in are we about 20 minutes in or 15 minutes in?
13 I reckon, Murphy.
13 minutes in, and we still have yet to mention Dupont's handoff.
Which one?
Well, there's like one. There was a few, but there was one in particular where, because most people when they do a nice clean handoff, it's usually top of the head, forehead, or maybe close to the neck, and then what happens is the defender can't get their arms around you, and you're gone. But one of them, I'll have to replay it again at home, but one of them looked like he handed someone off in the hip. Someone came close to him, and because he's so squat, he pushed him, sort of pushed their hip away, and then by the time they'd recovered, he was gone again. He is unreal. I know all the plaudits are on him, and I mean he's World Player of the Year. So, but I think the TV people covered it as well. He just stood out a mile. Mm. I think it might be Paul Williams actually, the journalist. He said seeing him in the flesh at ground level is just he just stands out a mile. Just at the absolute class of. Oozes off him.
Yeah.
And to have the courage to, again, in part of a great team, part of two great teams that he's part of, but to actually, when everybody else was getting a bit shy and dropping the ball at line out and all the back moves weren't quite clicking and stuff like that, for him to actually turn around and just grab the game by the scruff of the neck. I mean, Yeah, okay, here we go. Yesterday's cliche. It's like Gareth Edwards kind of style of, I better go and score. I better go and sort it out then. And to do that in the modern game is just, you know, it's almost impossible for one single player to just dominate, you know, a game like that with such determination and character. It's not just his incredible ability and skill. It's actually, it takes guts to do it. Character. That's what he's got. He's got character.
In many ways, it wasn't a modern game, which was just the kind of the sheer beauty. I mean, this is mental, isn't it? Like how much we're raving about a game that finished 39-7. But there is something to be said for the spirit that the game was played in, the courage that those Cardiff lads played from, you know, and as a team unit. And I just think that it's really important now that they kick on and it's not flash in the pan and this is all forgotten in January when they've lost away to Connacht or something like that. You know, I just hope that they're able to do something, because I think it's important for rugby in Wales to have days like that. You know, I can only imagine what the atmosphere was like on the ground. Like you said, it came across on the telly magnificently, and I can only imagine that the Arms Park was rocking. It's good when there's a sellout down there anyway, but that felt like an old school atmosphere.
I keep hearing sellout, but on TV
it wasn't a sellout, but it was close to, yeah.
Yeah, you could see, you know, yawning gaps in the stand and the terrace, but sometimes they, I tell you the good comparison would be Boxing Day.
Yeah,
because Boxing Day, they could probably sell it twice on Boxing Day. Mm. So we'll see if it compares, you know, with yesterday's, because there was definitely space around the edges yesterday.
The other thing to consider, Jed, is how much did the preamble to the game, how much did the publicity, how much did that galvanise everybody? You know, it's not just a case of everybody turned up and then got excited. It is actually to do with the... And so how much of the sort of media coverage of the game actually creates those things, and the fact is that in the competitions normally, you know, the Welsh media is small and insignificant, and so everybody's not really maybe as galvanised as they would be normally. I don't know. I mean, it's worthwhile thinking about whether that had a part to play and whether the media has a part to play in getting everybody as excited for that game as they will do
I think it was bigger than the Welsh media, though. That's the thing, is I think, you know, there was a degree of that. But I think actually the fact that it was on Channel 4 made a big difference as well. For the first game and the narrative that I didn't see all of the pre-match build-up, but it was good to have Miles Harrison on comms. And, you know, the guy's a pro, and... You know, he did it in quite a good way. There was a pitch side match with him where he kind of just alluded to what it meant to that game. And I don't know, again, I'm probably over romanticising this massively, but it did feel like it was that siege mentality kind of applied to the city rather than to just fans of the club.
What I'm suggesting is that the fact is that the narratives that we normally give in pre-match preparation or pre-match hype are not good enough. That if you are involved in public relations and communications, you've got to do a job that actually invigorates and excites the public.
Yeah.
And so that was a story that was kind of easy. I'm not saying that every week is going to be like that, but I could all that kind of, we've seen countless preamble, you know, TV adverts for instance, for the local derbies, and they're always just blood and thunder, cliche, blah blah blah. It's like, oh, we've been here before. It's just we're rebadging the same old content every year. Yeah. And I think you just have to work harder. I think it's the broadcaster's job and it's the media's job to work harder to hype these games in order to get them to really connect with people. When I use the word hype, it's a negative thing, but you understand what I mean, in that if you can really truly tap into what people really care about a sport or care about the club, you know, that's where Exeter Chiefs to, you know, obviously at the heart of, you know, a controversy at the moment, but that's why, you know, clubs like that develop their own kind of, you know, narrative.
It helps that they're winning, though. Yes,
Leinster, or yeah, exactly.
You know, these are sides who play Exeter play meaningful rugby week in, week out. And Cardiff, yeah, go on, Murph.
Sorry, I think that's a really good point there. Yes, because the narrative could or should be from the media surrounding the Welsh clubs is these teams are hopelessly out-resourced and moneyed, exactly, and financed and everything else. But guess what? On Saturday, they're going to have a right old crack. Mm. Yeah. Which is basically what last week was. Like, that was obviously an extreme example. But, you know, it generally seems to be, the Ospreys are going to play Leinster and, they might be okay. You know, that kind of thing. But if they sell it and, we're massive underdogs every time we go on the pitch, like, I don't know what the comparison is in football.
Well, but it's Wimbledon. It's Wimbledon. It's the crazy gang. It's why, say, Burnley fans. It's why Crystal Palace, for instance. We talked about this off air before with Jed. You know, the atmosphere at those games. They create that atmosphere because they know they're always going to be the underdog.
It's a brilliant point. The regions are championship clubs.
Yeah,
but taking on Premiership opposition every week. That's not the case when they're playing Zebre, obviously. But you know, when they
it's not a million miles away, is it? Yeah, no. Europe or to the Irish sides. It is just like that. And you're right. That's not something that you should be like, oh, well, this is an excuse for losing. It should be the thing that riles you up to really want to overachieve.
Let's stick it up these wealthy ponces.
But you can't. It's very difficult for the Welsh media to accept the fact because they don't want to be talking down the product because the regions aren't going to accept that. They're going to be upset by the fact that they're being sold as a. But I think everybody was in agreement about the situation, and if everybody looked at the real truth of the issue,
well, everyone who follows rugby closely knows that they've got no money relative to other
and
clubs.
I've got no time for that. You know, there's no point. You can't criticise Leinster for being massively resourced. Yeah. No. Do you know what I mean? It's like that's ridiculous. It's like criticise. You know, it's just ludicrous. You know, they've done really, really well. And they've done really well to resource their region, and therefore they should be applauded for having done the job that they've done. But you know, I understand the sort of the resentment in football, for instance, for clubs who are just checkbook led clubs. But yeah, we need to tell a different story, basically, is what I'm saying. Well, and I think that Saturday was an example of telling a different story and making people excited.
It's a great
about
point,
a product.
Yes, yeah.
If anyone from the club is listening, Murph has just given the perfect slogan for the away day to Harlequins next week, which is "Let's stick it up these wealthy ponces." I think you're going to be hard pressed to come up with anything better than that. But do you know? Is it because I see it so much, and I don't know. Again, like kind of working in the industry a little bit, I just get fed up of these tropes of just like, we are Cardiff Rugby. It's like, yeah, you've said your name. That's nothing. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, we are England Cricket. It's like, this is bullshit. None of this means anything. Yeah. Like, just, yeah, tell a story to your, you know, to your fans that's going to get them excited. And it's a hard thing to do. I think it's one thing to do it when it's Toulouse and your back's against the wall. It's hard when it's Connacht at home in this bullshit league.
But at the same time, you just have a picture of two players with their arms folded looking hard on the poster. Yeah. It's just not enough.
No, it's not. I agree.
The players can't sell the thing. It's like saying, so imagine Keir Starmer puts on a skin tight shirt and then wears and then folds his arms, and that's the poster for the Labour Party for the next general election. I mean, maybe he'll get away with it.
Power stance, I reckon.
Yeah, power stance for that's Keir's power stance. WRU take over. Yeah. Oh no, it's unfair. It's always the WRU get it in the neck. You know, rugby clubs take over the marketing of political parties, and suddenly everybody's just got a power stance, and then it's like, okay, fair enough. Who are you going to vote for? Yeah.
With a picture of a meaningless trophy in the middle. Yeah,
exactly.
The James Bevan Trophy, like.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just that's what you just gotta tell. There's so many great people out there doing really imaginative, interesting stories and kind of galvanizing people and getting people to turn up, you know, to things. And we just gotta work harder at it. You know, it's just not enough to say we are, like you said, Jed, you know, we have an identity. Well, what is your identity?
Yeah, we have a name. Yeah, it's just not it's not enough. And look, you know, the identity thing might open up a massive wormhole, but you know, Cardiff, whether you agree with it or not, have gone back to the Cardiff branding, which obviously identifies with the previous version of the amateur era version of the club, the pre-regional version. And I, if I'm honest, I think that probably helps shift a few more tickets or generate a bit more interest than a fraction, you know, than the Cardiff Blues version of the identity, which is a little bit of a lager shandy. Do you know what I mean? It's like it was neither one thing nor the other. It was you're never going to get Ponty fans supporting a team with Cardiff in the name, but half the bloody first team are boys from Ponty, you know, and I'm not saying that's right. There's no team from Ponty to support, but if you are working for Cardiff, you've got to make it work. You've got to make that team work.
What would be effective is like the idea of everybody was talking about Aberavon yesterday, yeah. Right? It's like, you know, if regional players were going and from, you know, coming from Aberavon and playing for Cardiff Rugby, that was something that people could connect with. It's the same if you said that these people are from Pontypridd, you know, it's almost like having your, you know, like, you know, like clubs have, like Bath has always got the little, you know, national identity yeah. badge on their shirt, you know. It's almost like you need that kind of, I think you need to tap into that sort of going, you can tap into that regional identity or the local identity and bring it into the club. So it's been my bugbear with Ospreys, for instance, is that there's no sense of where these people are from and where they come from and what they, and the clubs that they play for regularly or the junior clubs they played for, you know, even with the Chris Chunza story that everybody grabbed that because he was from Whitchurch or, you know, he's studying at Exeter, you know, that kind of these stories mean things to people, you know, they want to identify people from, you know, when you got people from Clydach and Pontypridd, you know, thinking they're in different, practically in different time zones, even though they're only about half a mile away from each other. I think it's really important to sort of, I don't know, with you, Murph, you must feel this much stronger than I do because of the Wanderers link and the fact that, you know, that so many players have gone from that club and gone to play for Cardiff.
Well, this sounds like, in a roundabout way, this sounds like an indictment of academies, because the academies pick players up early, rob them of their local identity, obviously, turn up, you know, generic rugby players to feed up into professional rugby. And the weird thing about yesterday was all these players were playing in Premiership rugby or whatever standard they were playing, and they would have to be drafted in to make the numbers. And suddenly there's loads of identity on the pitch and everyone's interested in it, rather than just these kind of bland academy products, which is, I don't know how you solve that really. Well, also, I'm not, unless Jed apologizes for insulting Shandy, I'm not doing the rest of this podcast. Nothing wrong with Shandy.
Oh yeah,
on a Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, I'm having a Guinness myself.
Mate, I didn't have you down as a shandy drinking.
I'm not a shandy guy, no. But yeah. You know, it's harsh. You know, Mrs. Murphy is a committed shandy drinker.
But yeah, well, there you have it. Look, we're going to take a very quick break. When it comes to the second half, I'm sure we're going to tread onto this. This issue of identity and regional rugby and how the regions kind of kick on, particularly when we go into the Christmas period, when, you know, traditionally we have those kind of half decent crowd. So we're definitely going to do that. We'll have a look at the Dragons and Ospreys games as well, and touch on the other news. And who knows, we maybe even might have time for a little trawl through the Rothmans Rugby Yearbook 95-96. So all of that is coming up after this very quick break. Welcome to the second half of the Attacking Scrum podcast. Thoroughly enjoyed that first half, boys. It was like, exactly like I said, like the first 20 minutes of the Cardiff game on Saturday. Some really interesting stuff that you've touched on there. Like, I think particularly we haven't got all night. So whenever we open the issues of identity and regional rugby and everything else, I do think it's a bit of a dangerous thing, because you can't look back and go, well, the days were better when we had, you know, when we had 12 sides in the, you know, in the top flight and all stuff like that, because it doesn't matter. There's not enough money for four decent sides now, yet alone 12. But it is a question of how you get people engaged with it. And you're right there, Murph. You know, obviously a lot of those players come through an academy system, so they're not 22 years old and playing for the Wanderers or playing for Taibach or whoever. But at the same time, there will have been some degree of engagement at a club. You know, Warburton did a bit of the Wanderers. You know, obviously Dan Fish is heavily linked to the Wanderers, and I think that there should be more done to kind of identify with those clubs. I know they're not feeder clubs per se, but, like, you know, in the same way that every you know, that Barbarians players always wear their club socks and stuff like that. And I love some of those stories around it. You know, Jerry Collins wearing whatever it was, Barnstable or something, because he turned out for a training session with them. And on that tie-back point, Richard Hibbard wore those socks when he played for the Barbarians a few years ago, rather than his Osprey socks or whatever. And I think that's, like, stuff like that, I think, is... there will be players who identify with clubs, even if they've only played 5 or 10 games for them at Premiership level, because that's been a significant part of their development, even if they weren't their man and boy, you know, drinking and smoking behind the bike sheds, like, you know, like the romanticised version would suggest. So, I don't know. I've always thought it, like, you know, the Dragons, it was obvious when the money went from them early doors that, yeah, you'd made a bungled job of calling this side Newport Gwent Dragons, and it sat as a nothing thing, you know, it sat somewhere in between. And even now, Dragons doesn't really mean anything. Like, I know Gwent is a kind of a relatively modern and defunct concept, but it does kind of mean something in rugby terms. You know, I think there are clubs within that Gwent region that have brilliant and proud history, and Gwent or Monmouthshire, you know, has they've turned out as Monmouthshire in years gone by. I just think that not enough, so many of these things, it was such a half-assed, halfway house to begin with, that we're now in a position where you've got to find that way forward, and you've got to find ways of getting people excited and going to the stadium and getting engaged with it. Because if I'm honest, like I've said a million times, the league isn't going to do that.
Well, my feeling is that I always... kind of my contributions to this amazing podcast are usually based on pure romanticism and retrospective viewing, and I always think, you're just, what are you doing? Yes, you're just, you know, you're just pissing in the air. But actually yesterday was an indication of what could happen. Mm. You know, it was certainly gave clues to how some level of engagement could be created. I'm not saying yesterday was a microcosm of everything, it's going to be like this forevermore, but it certainly indicated something. It gave us a sense of spirit that we haven't seen. And it was, like you say, it might be forgotten in February, but I don't think anybody's going to forget that day or that, you know, and everybody's got, I think it's something to build on is what I'm saying. I'm trying to say that it's not pissing the wind. There are opportunities there. And I can see now that that means something. It's not just idle romanticism. It means something. And you can build on it. And Cardiff Rugby are probably the first, you know, organization in who recognized the importance of authentic, some sort of creating an authentic identity. And then they, through no fault of their own, have been thrust into this situation and done really well with it. It's back to the football and the way that the Welsh football team and the Welsh football, the FA of Wales has engaged with its public in a more effective way, 10 times more effective way than the WRU has done with its public. Mm. And you just got it. And what's all that down to? Things like the use of the Welsh language, recognition of where the people come from, an acknowledgement that everybody has to play a part, the players have to play a part in it. It's not just, you know, all of a very sophisticated and well thought out strategy that has brought people together. And it's not just because, you know, they've tragically lost a manager and all those things. It's much, much more than that. It's not just a simple answer. And as Welsh Rugby can do that, there's no question they can do it. But they need to not just be banging out crap messages and shit marketing, and they need to recognize what's real about all this.
Bland messages.
Bland yeah. is it, actually, isn't it? Like there's some hilarious examples of I'll have to try and dig them out if anyone's interested, but of the way Brazil rugby market themselves. Because they know they're crap, they market themselves in this way of they're like, you know, it was like at the South American Championships, you know, over the course of 10 years, Argentina have got no better. Brazil have improved 200% because they've gone from like, you know, 10th to 8th or something. And I just thought, well, you know, having a sense of humour or just a point of difference is a really, really good and exciting thing rather than, you know, the general generic tropes and platitudes that we get, that you get fed by every rugby club, every sports organisation up and down the country. And it's hard. I know it's hard. It's one thing doing it for Toulouse at home when your back's against the wall and you feel like your club's fighting for existence. It's a different thing when it's Zebra in the middle of January and it's a largely meaningless game. It is hard, but I just think that there is so much that's there to be done, and is worth fighting for, because we need some kind of club rugby in Wales to cling on to. Murph, you're not in the way there, Murph. I'd love to get your thoughts.
You have to give me a more specific question than that. Otherwise, I'm just going to say I agree. Listen, we've been over this. I suppose everyone in Welsh rugby has been over this many times before, but regional rugby happened because there was too many teams and not enough money. It's a tiny country and you can't support all these teams on the basis of a small area of South Wales. Mm. So it had to be cut, and no one liked the way it was cut. And I don't know what else they could have done. But we are where we are, like you say, and now it's got to, what you've got has got to work better. Mm. And the trouble is, over the last, was it 2004 they went regional?
Yeah.
So we're up to 17 years of regional rugby. And aside from the Galacticos at Ospreys for a while, there's been very little, you know, success. Even when the Galacticos at the Ospreys, I mean, if you look back at the team on paper of what was playing for the Ospreys, the crowds were pathetic. Mm. I mean, you had Tommy Bowe on one wing and Shane Williams on the other. Marty Holler, Tia, all sorts of names. But Justin Marshall with Mike Phillips on the bench. I mean, what? And there was, you know, 10,000 people maybe. So they've got to, I mean, the problem is not clearly not solved, and they've got to keep finding a way, haven't they? And the kind of the way it's marketed, I suppose, is a start.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. And yeah, it's you're right, there's only kind of a few small pockets of that Galacticos Osprey side, and you know, the Scarlets going on the run to win the Pro 12, and I suppose the two Challenge Cups that Cardiff have won in that time as well. But yeah, you know, these things are kind of are fleeting, aren't they?
Yeah, there's been no consistent side. You know, like, say, for example, over that period, you could say that one or two of the Irish sides have been near the top the whole time. And we've had, like you say, you mentioned there, Ospreys have won the league and Scarlets had won the league. But no Welsh team has been regularly good. And there's no reason why they can't be regularly good, really. Well, that is, I mean, but there's no reason in reality why they can't be regularly good.
More importantly, in a way, that they should be. It should be exciting for the people to go to. That's the thing. Yeah. It's about, and that will galvanise things and will help things. You know, otherwise, let's just get rid of crowds completely and just call the whole thing off. You know, just turn it into a TV. You know, a game just made for TV, which is what, as I said the other week, that's what it feels like, that the Welsh Rugby Union are doing with the Welsh team.
Yeah, and I still say, and I said this to many people over many years, if there was a Welsh team, a Welsh regional team, any of them actually, but I just use the one local to me as an example, Cardiff, if they were operating in the latter stages of the European Cup on a regular basis, or dare I say it, if they were the dominant force in Europe, like Saracens were in the last 6 or 7 years, you'd struggle to buy a season ticket at Cardiff.
Yeah.
But they've never regularly been any good. Therefore, attendances are average and there's no... But it's chicken and the egg, obviously, because you've got to string some victories together.
Yeah, but I still think it's not. I don't blame the players, and I don't blame the talent on the pitch. Like I say, Crystal Palace don't do too bad. You know, Wimbledon didn't do too bad with a bunch of Herberts playing and for them. And you know, obviously some talented footballers, but that kind of thing. It starts. You know, Wales, the Welsh football team is not. It is noticeably more successful than it was. And the reason it's noticeably successful than what it was is because it has. Part of the reason is because it's galvanized everyone. You know, if the crowds are turning up and being, if there's an engagement between the people who go to watch the game and the people who play the game, If there's a closeness between them, everybody ups their game. Everybody improves, you know. And I think there's no question that the Welsh regions would be better with more people in the stadium and with the sense of excitement about it and that the sense of jeopardy and the sense of that, you know, everyone is invested in it. I know what you mean. If you're right, you know, it's not. It is ultimately a numbers game, but I think there are also, you know, you can't deny that. I mean, you know, the Parc of Scarlets, for goodness sake, you know, is it ever anywhere near? Even when they were at their most successful, the only time it was full was for local derby. Anywhere near full. And all these stadia are not fit for purpose for the teams that are playing.
But it's the jeopardy there though, Justin. That's the crucial thing for me. You know, whether it's jeopardy, whether it's meaningful games or whatever we call it, it all comes back to this. Because so much rugby yesterday, there was something riding on it, and it wasn't even the result of the game because we all knew that they were never going to beat Toulouse. But it was about a sense of occasion and pride, and look, they won the battle for pride, right? And there's just so many games that mean absolutely jack squat. And I think if you were, you know, like I say, you can't go back to a 10-team Premiership or a 12-team Premiership because, well, we know why. We're struggling to get four teams that work, but there is just so much rugby that just simply doesn't work. You know, it means absolutely nothing. The league is such a mess. Like, I've said it a million times, and look, it's very fashionable to bash the URC or the pro, whatever it is. And it, but there's a reason for that. It's because it's crap. Like, it's just not a thing. No one cares. Like, ask, you know, ask, ask Irish fans how the Welsh region's got on. They don't know. It was only through looking at the result, trying to look up who Cardiff were playing the following week, that I realised Ulster had beaten Leinster at home. And it's like, that's a bit, that in theory is a big result, but it's just a mess because it's not a coherent league, you know. And nothing has highlighted that more than the last 3 weeks. And there was a lot of anger directed the way of European rugby this week from Scarlets fans, which I get, because they weren't able to postpone the game. And, you know, Toulouse, I think, postponed a game last year, didn't they, in, you know, in circumstances not as mad as this. But really, that anger should be directed at a league that's trying to take sides to South Africa in the middle of a global pandemic. And
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah. Now you say that out loud.
Yeah, it's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But yeah, and even, you know, that's the thing, is it's like, you know, on paper, oh, it's way more interesting having the Stormers in the league. It's not. It doesn't mean anything. Like, if you had a cup competition where the Stormers were in it, there is a degree of excitement about this, you know.
Doesn't it turn out that we've been over this before? Doesn't it turn out that it looks like the only reason the South Africans have been put into our league is so they can come into Europe next year?
Well, there's that, and, you know.
Yeah. So it's not just us who are getting jumping into bed with a ridiculous situation. The European rugby,
absolutely,
whatever they call themselves,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
is doing,
well,
the same thing.
Yeah. And you know, you talk about people diluting a good tournament. That happened with the you know, whatever that power struggle was in 2013 when they created the Champions Cup and all this kind of stuff. And it was way stronger when it was the Heineken Cup, because people knew it and had identified with it. And that was and that had a sponsor's name slapped all over it. And it's like, you can't create something out of thin air and then go, well, this is going to be better than it was before. Without any real plan for how it was. I understand the problem that it wasn't really a meritocracy before, and we were guaranteed entry pretty much. Only three of the Welsh regions qualified for automatic, so did three of the Irish. And I kind of get that France and England had the ump about that, but has it been better since 2013 or worse? I'd argue worse. But
yeah. Just backtracking, if you don't mind, a sec, back to the Welsh FA marketing and social media people. That campaign that was alongside the 2016 Euros, which was, I think, Together Stronger, hashtag on Twitter, Together Stronger, that is still being ripped off now, six years later. And as soon as the tournament was over, Wales, we had the victory parade and everything else in Cardiff, and that social media guy or woman or PR person or woman, whoever it was immediately poached by the English FA. And so and I've noticed a lot of their campaigns sound very similar to that campaign.
Well, and also and to be fair to England, they did a brilliant job in demonstrating the humanity of their players in very difficult circumstances.
Within 2 years, they were beaten finalists at 2018, were they?
Semi-finalists,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but also they having been derided for being
prima donnas,
baby Bentley driving multi-millionaire prima donnas, they're suddenly human beings that everybody started identifying with, and became, had a political voice even. You know, all these things are don't happen in they don't happen by accident.
No.
They do not happen by accident. These are sophisticated, you know, methods of media management and communication.
Yeah, I definitely think
I love rugby though. It's getting to that point where we've kind of completely neglected.
Just to finish then, there's definitely a middle road between where we are now with professional players, if you know what I mean, where they're just kind of, I don't know, worshipped on social media or whatever they are, and they're just pedestal type looks. And for me, the type of cult heroes you get in Irish Gaelic sports. Mm. So they're all amateur. They're all from round the corner from you. And yet they're playing in the highest level in the country. And they're like in that team for best part of 20 years. And for they're just cult heroes from their first good game until their last game. And there's something we don't quite... The Welsh rugby team gets that, I think. But it doesn't seem to be the local boy being amazing. And we all, if he has a bad game or a good game, we worship him. That kind of cult following, cult hero thing doesn't really happen
in the regions. It's a brilliant point. I mean, part of it, I think, is the amateur status. But secondly, you're absolutely right. I mean, like, if you look at, and I'm sure we will briefly touch on the Dragons game, right? But you look at that side or the squad on paper, so many of them are from Newport or surrounding areas, but you can't talk about Newport. You know what I mean? Because for a number of reasons.
you're trying to do
the regional thing. You've also pissed off Newport RFC again, for right or wrong. We won't go into that now, but you can't talk about, you know, and the thing that you've touched on there, Murph, the cult hero, it's that relatable character. It's not someone who is like Cristiano Ronaldo, because that's not what gets people to relate to these individuals. But, you know, is Harry Keddy a really nice bloke who just loves rugby and turns up and plays for his side and plays his guts out every week? Yeah, 100% on all of those things. Tick 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 tick. And is he a local boy? Yes, but do we tell people that the side is full of that? No. There's just all of these kind of missed opportunities. Ollie Griffiths is from Newport. Tane Basham's from Newport. Elliot Dees from Newbridge.
Aaron Wainwright's from Malpas.
You know, all of these things. It comes back to that bit of identity. You know, even if it's this Gwent identity, but there's heaps of them in there who are like that. And again, obviously the squad isn't just that, but it's something to hang your hat on. Because what are you going to do? Say, oh well, we've got bugger all money. That's why we lose all but three games every season. You know, it's there is just a point about making people attached to a side that hasn't really existed prior to 17 years before it. It was easier for Cardiff to roll back the years on Saturday because it's Cardiff again now.
Mm. Although,
how were the Dragons, Jared?
Decent for 50 minutes. Basher was outstanding again. Will Rowlands is brilliant. And then we took three kicks to the corner and got turned over the line three times. Then a massive second row who stripped the ball from our entire pack whilst over the line on two occasions. And then Elliot D had his head taken off, but the fella only got a yellow because he was dipping. But if he'd have stood upright, he'd have had his head taken off as well. So it was a complete bottle job from the officials. But it was probably a bottle job from the players. I think they all know they should have won that game. You just got to put away. So Perpignan aren't massively interested in this game because they're fighting for their own lives. They played really poorly. And the Dragons will know they should have put them away. But they're just a side that's completely void of confidence, and it showed, unfortunately.
Yeah. Can I also put in a word for the Ospreys kit? Because let's just, you know, spend the rest of the pod talking about that.
Grotesque,
what,
isn't it?
What was going on there then? I mean, is any rhyme or reason for that?
It's like camouflage with yellow socks, with orange socks.
Yeah.
It's a weird look, isn't it? Yeah. It did very little for me. Unfortunately, I haven't seen the game. But it's been a hell of a week for the Ospreys. I mean, the story that has dominated has been the Ivan Phillips stuff. And that's... you can only imagine how much that must rock a club, whether it's a local club or it's a fully professional club. I think it's incredibly sad, and you know, you hope for the best, but that must have had an impact on preparations for that game.
Yeah.
They all wore the number two when they were training, weren't they, before the game?
Am I the only one who got caught out by this story? Because I saw the fundraiser before I even knew he'd had an accident. Am I the only one who got caught out of that?
I think you boys let me know about it. I don't spend as much time on social media as I did, and you boys alerted me to it, and... Yeah, the first thing I saw was the fundraiser.
Yeah, so then I was going, well, what's happened to Ivan Phillips?
Yeah.
And then obviously I started looking into it, and then this is how off the pace I am sometimes, is I didn't know he was Kevin Phillips' son.
That's great.
I would have definitely had you down for that.
Yeah, I know. No idea.
Oh, that's surprising.
He hasn't even shaved his head. How can he be Kevin Phillips' son? But, tragic. Such a promising player as well.
I thought he had all the hallmarks of a guy who was going to play for Wales at 27 or 28 or something and be really, really good, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, really awful, awful, awful.
Yeah, no, it is absolutely. And, you know, it's... it's one of those where you don't know the full story again. I mean, obviously, as Murph said, Murph and I didn't know half the story before while it had happened. But you're never going to know until the club and the family release something, and so you just hope for the best possible news.
Yeah, it's just fingers crossed that it's just you can't play rugby and not completely life changing or debilitating. Just something that means he can't carry on being a professional rugby player. And the rest of his life is okay, you know?
Yeah, no, so it's very, very sad stuff. What do you want to do for the last couple of minutes of the show? Do you want to take a look at next week's fixtures, or would you rather I open a random page of the Rothmans Rugby Yearbook?
Both of those, actually, but I was just going to say I sort of fancied the Ospreys yesterday because Sale haven't gone well this year, and... when I was watching, I haven't seen the game, but when I was watching the score, I think they were 21-3 behind in no time at all. And then for that reason, I opened up the live score type of thing to see what was going on. And I just looked at the team sheets, and the Ospreys back row was Will Griffiths, Levi Roots, is that his name? Levi? And
Ethan Roots, yeah.
Martin
Morgan
Morris. Yeah, Martin Morris.
Martin Morris.
Right, that's fine. But when you look at the Sale back row, then they've got two Curries and a Dupria up against Levi Roots, Will Griffiths, and Martin Morris. And that, I think, is... I mean, they played well, from what I understand, played well to come back to make it close. But the writing was on the wall from the selection, I think, a little bit. The back rows just didn't match up at all.
It is one of those areas. Go ahead.
I saw bits of it, and it just Sale's defence is sturdy. They might be struggling in the Prem, but they looked aggressively dominant off their sort of blitzing defence, basically, and it didn't look like Ospreys had any way around them. In any way, shape, or form, to be honest, they were out-muscled in terms of trying to find a way through. Prothero did his usual kind of cameo darting sort of stuff, but it didn't look it didn't look like they had any real. They were certainly weren't. Ospreys were not robbed, and they did fight their way back in, but it wasn't particularly. It was an opportunity for them to stamp, to kind of actually build some momentum again. And they didn't take that opportunity.
They're a very strange team this year, the Ospreys.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's interesting that back row that you mentioned there, Murph, as well, because it's no disrespect to any of those players, because I think particularly 6 and 8, they're decent prospects. I've been thoroughly underwhelmed by Ethan Roots, but the other two, I think Griffiths has been a really good squad player in the mould of that kind of Cracknell player who will turn out and always put a good shift in for you. Morgan Morris, I think, is a really good prospect. But in games like this, you need players like Tipperick on the pitch. You need Alan Wynne-Jones on the pitch. You need
Lydiot.
You need a Lydiot. You need players who can who've been to the highest level and actually I think the back row is probably that weakest area for the Ospreys actually. I think
Jack Morgan was supposed to play and then cried off at the last minute.
Yeah.
Mm. And but it's a lot of pressure.
That would have been interesting to see him up against one of the Curries.
Mm. It's a lot of pressure on a 21, 22-year-old, though, isn't it? To go, right, I need you to put in the kind of shift that a Tipperick would do for us. Like I say, I think Morgan is, Morgan's a... I'm such a massive fan of him. It's those things that are missing in the Ospreys squad. I don't know, I'm starting to sound like a bit of an Ospreys apologist now, and it's difficult without seeing that game, but... you're right, they're a funny team this year, Murph, because when they win, they grind out results and don't do anything in the backs.
Not that long ago, they beat Munster at home, and it was an amazing game. You know, people like Rhys Davies, some of you, I think I said on here, Bradley Davies, they're amazing, but they've also beat that Connacht game away, I think it was.
Oh, yeah, horrible. And,
but then they've also done the Lions at home, where they were just a shambles.
One of the South African sides.
A South African team named after an animal. That seems to be the kind of blueprint for rugby PR that we've been talking about.
Yeah, because it's generic. It's generic.
Pick an animal and stick it on the back of our city name, and then if a sponsor come in, drop the city name.
Yeah.
And no one knows where the fuck we come from. Yeah. And that's us.
But crucially,
where's my wages?
Yeah. The thing is, I know what a Toyota is more than I know who the fucking cheaters are. You know, I don't know. I know where Johannesburg is. It's a famous place, right? I know where Cardiff is. I don't know, man. We've gone down some a few avenues, haven't we?
Anyway, Rothmans.
Right.
What was the options? Rothmans or restructuring of the league? I think Rothmans every single day of the week.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely go for that. Right. let us go for... Oh, what's this? Right. I think it has to be Welsh related until we've exhausted everything.
Well, we've only done one season, so I mean...
Well, all we did was the cup final, wasn't it, actually?
Exactly.
Right, let's have a look. I'm going to do the immortal lines of talk amongst yourself, Murph. But you actually have got someone to talk to this time around, which didn't have last time.
No. Right. And weirdly, I did a better job on my own talking amongst myself.
Why don't we go to the Five Nations of this year? Let's do that, shall we? Let's go to the Five Nations of 94, 95. Do you have any memories of that off the top of your head?
Oh. I was at the enemy at that time, and I don't think anything outside of the world, outside of the embryonic world of Britpop meant anything to me whatsoever.
Outside of being taken into the hacienda.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I got a story about that. It wasn't that 94, 95, it was 93. 93, I played a morning game at the Wanderers with a guy called John Bunyan and a guy called Peter Rogers, who were both just club players at the Wanderers. And Peter Rogers drove us into town to watch the game, parked up somewhere. I can't remember where. Well, no one does. Went into the game. Wales beat England 10-9. Then we went in the bank after. Remember the bank? had a good time. And the following week, we went to training and Peter Rogers still couldn't find his car. Didn't know where he'd left it. And this might be telling stories out of, what goes on tour, stays on tour and everything. But I think he actually went to a hypnotist in 93 to see if he could remember where his car was in Poncana or Riverside. Or it was probably right outside the Coldstream pub, which is now gone. He never found it. He never found his car again. So that was my story from Wales, England, 1990.
That's way better than the Rothmans. Sorry, John. Unless you've got
something
to come up with. Well, we'll see. All I was going to do is say, Murph, which musical publication were you working for at the time?
yeah, no, I don't think I was I don't think I was very employable in the 90s or or now.
Well, which leads us seamlessly on to the Wales side that took on France in Paris in January of this year.
Oh, man.
All right. Here we go. The score was France 21, Wales 9.
Okay, I'm going Olivier Merle, headbutt. Yes, I am. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, you're on
Ricky Evans, yep. The fireman, out cold, right. Broke his leg on the way down to the ground.
That is correct.
So now all we're going to do now is fill in the blanks. Yes, no problem.
Wow, I'm done on that. That's fantastic. That's a brilliant memory.
Olivier Merle used to give it. Olivier Merle is in the same category for me as Andrew Kembry. It is. Absolutely fucking petrifies me. And I don't know what they do now. I imagine Olivier Merle and Andrew Kembry are both in a high security prison in America somewhere. They're not allowed to have any any metal objects within 100 meters of them. They just live in a cage.
There's less chance of Olivier Merle drinking in shady boozers in Cardiff, isn't there?
For all I know, they're both like primary school teachers. I don't know, but in my imagination, they just eat raw animals and petrified. Yeah. Andrew Kembry used to really scare me.
That is what this game was famous for. It was disgusting, wasn't it? I think he successfully sued him later, didn't he? Or prosecuted or something. I'll have to look that up and clarify that at the end. But it was, it ended Ricky Evans' career, didn't it?
I didn't realise that. He was one of those late flourishing props that used to be a thing.
Yeah.
Back in the day, he'd come into their own when they're about 32, and then have three great seasons. You know.
I certainly don't ever remember him playing for Wales after that.
No.
I'm sure it ended his. His international career. Right.
Okay, so what was the Welsh 15?
Okay, so you've got Ricky Evans at 3.
Okay.
Stick in 95. The front row.
95. No. Jonathan Humphreys.
Not Jonathan Humphreys. One of your mob, Yestin. No, sorry.
Garin?
Yeah, it was Garin.
Well, Garin was already there, okay.
Yeah. Sorry, Ricky Evans was Loosehead, by the way. Yeah, of course. Right. Garin was
so
two.
This might be John Davis, one of John Davis's early caps where he had his flying wings.
It was John Davis, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it might have been his later cap, actually. But anyway, so that means second row, mid-90s second row.
Now, one of these made an awful lot of appearances for Wales. And one of these has made an awful lot of money out of Welsh rugby players.
Oh, Derwin Jones and Gareth Llewellyn.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
back row is going to be Richard Webster back from league.
No. Mate, it's the same year, but from last year. How could that be the case?
You're obsessed with 95.
It's the only book I've got.
Oh, right. Oh, it's the same book.
No, it's the same. No, 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 it's the same book.
Okay. I misunderstood the premise altogether. okay. So Stuart Davis would have been in the side.
Correct.
Okay. I was going to say Richie Collins. It's too late for Richie Collins.
I was going to say, yeah.
He was there.
He still there?
In all his glory.
Right.
Brilliant.
So we're looking for a 6. Oh, Martin, the aforementioned Martin Morris?
No. No.
Nathan Budget.
No, too early for Nathan Budget. We're actually looking for an 8. I think Stuart Davis played at 6 on this occasion.
Emma Lewis.
Okay. No, a previous guest on this show, actually, believe it or not.
No, that's confused me, that. Jamie Roberts was playing 8 in the mid-90s. I mean, come on. A previous guest on this show.
And I have to say, he was a really, really thoroughly nice bloke. Famous Welsh player. Perhaps more famous for playing in the row than at 8. But did both.
Paul Arnold? No.
No.
What am I on about? Oh, this is hard. He'd been a guest on this show.
Perhaps you didn't listen to this one.
I doubt it. I mean, I doubt I missed it. John Taylor. John Taylor has been on this show.
20 years after he retired, came out to play.
Di Bishop.
It was not Di Bishop. It's Phil Davis.
I forgot he'd been on. Yeah.
The backs, I think, should be considerably easier.
So Arwell Thomas is playing 10? No. This is not the same game where he punch the scrum half?
No, it was a different year, that was a few years later, I think.
Okay, Rob Jones is still going.
Rob Jones was going.
That means the 10 would have been... 90s. Was it too early for Neil Jenkins? Jenkins.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Neil Jenkins.
The left winger has been mentioned on this show already tonight.
Justin, you really let me down here.
I know. Like I said,
he's not lying, is he? You've got no idea.
I was fashioning. Hang on, I got Garin. I was fashioning the Britpop revolution at the time.
You could probably name the bass player in every minor Britpop.
If you want to know who was lining up for Sleeper,
I was going to say Sleeper was going to be my choice. Who was the bass player in Sleeper?
Actually, I don't know. Ah! The bass player in Sleeper, but Louise lives nearby.
She's super cool, isn't she? Yeah.
And John. I know John and Louis, so, you know, I mean, what can I say?
There we go. Right, come on, left wingers, you know this. Stop talking about Britpop, Murph.
Sorry, I just wanted to ask some questions about the band Manson then.
Oh, no, they weren't Britpop. No, they weren't.
No, they were just in
They were a British band in the 90s, a British indie band in the 90s, yeah.
Yeah. Which is just a bit of a blur, though, isn't it? Left winger. That wasn't deliberate, I promise. Left winger. Did we mention him? Alan Harris, Sammy Davis. Played for Swansea as well, no?
Oh.
This guy is in a senior position at the WIU.
Nigel Walker.
Oh, yeah, Ian Evans would have been on the other wing.
Actually, he wasn't. I think he'd broken his leg or something at this point in time. Right. He was definitely injured.
Yeah.
Yeah, right wing is a bit tougher.
Simon Hill.
Simon Hill's correct. Absolutely.
Wow, well done.
I thank you all. So was Tony Clement still going at fullback?
He was going at fullback, yep.
Well. Now we've got to pick the French side. We've got to pick the French side.
We don't have to pick the French side.
No, hang on.
You've still got the centres, and I will make you have a stab at it. Just because Mike Hall is correct.
Oh, I forgot the centres. Right. Oh, 12 for after now, are we?
And 12 is a...
Nigel Davis.
No, a real favourite player of mine. Played a long time after this. This must have been his first season, I guess.
First season... Lee Davis.
No.
Oh. No, I'm struggling.
I don't remember this. So this says that this guy was playing for Pontypool at the time. I remember him.
Mark Taylor.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, I don't remember him.
Yeah.
His dad was coach at Pontypool.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I can tell you a story. Do you want to hear a story?
It depends. It depends how much it's going to ruin the rest of yesterday's evening.
My dinner's ready.
Let's let Yestin depart while you guess the French side. Yestin, you go and have your dinner. It's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, Yestin.
We'll chat to you soon.
See you later. Say bye.
Goodbye.
This should be a Patreon bit, mate, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
I'd love to see how many people are sticking on for the last 2.5 minutes of the show while you guess the French side. There's some lovely players in it.
So let's just go to my favourite. It might be too late because wrong era, but Laurent Caban. Was he playing seven?
Laurent Caban was, yes. Yeah. And he was a brilliant player.
I don't really go any further.
Back row was superb, actually.
Okay. So back row, Laurent Caban. So I'm imagining Lauren Rodriguez is gone by then.
Lauren Rodriguez was gone, yes.
Number eight. So who would the number eight be? Because that's all 80s, isn't it? Like Eric Schomp and all them.
Yeah, they're all gone by now.
It's too early for Imanol Arunoduki because he was only a puppy in 99.
Yeah, far too early for him.
Now I'm struggling now. Abdelatif Benazi.
He was number six.
What a monster.
He was an absolute...
How can you have him on the blind side? He was absolutely huge.
It doesn't matter what he's wearing on his back. He's hitting you like he's getting hit by a phone box.
Yeah. We've mentioned Olivier Merle.
We have. So... And someone, his namesake in the second row as well.
Another Olivier?
Mm.
Uh-huh. Rumour,
yeah. It wasn't going to be Merle Haggard, was it?
Yeah. Lawrence. So the front row is going to be Masso and people like that?
It's not. There is a brilliant, the tight end was brilliant. One of the first modern tight end props, actually.
Oh, Califano.
Califano, no, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
oh Califano. Wow. Okay. Surprised myself there.
You're still missing number eight, by the way.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that. Do you want it? It's Philippe Benetton.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he started that team in Italy after.
He did, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, so we're just missing a hooker.
You're missing a hooker and a loose head.
And then
head,
I can move on to the backs that I haven't got a clue on.
You get the backs. You're missing a hooker and a loose head. The loose head, I don't remember at all. I don't remember the hooker either.
All right.
But I would have been nine. So my interest in front row. It was Benazesh was the loose head.
Oh, that's an obscure one.
Is it? Yeah. And Gonzalez was the hooker. And I don't remember. I definitely don't remember.
Right. Okay. So number nine.
They had a lot of nines. They rotated in the 90s. And this guy it
begins
was
with
a
C, though. Carbonneau.
It wasn't Carbonneau, but he would have been similar era.
Right. Well, Galtier was playing then.
Galtier was, and this is basically the other one.
Right. Can't remember the other one.
Guy Cossaberry.
All right. No chance. All right. Okay, Christophe Lemaison was playing 10.
It wasn't Lemaison, but it was a Christophe.
Camberbero?
No, there it is. Was he Christophe?
I don't know.
No, I don't think he was. Christophe Dalo.
Oh, right. Yeah. All right. Okay. Dalo, yeah.
You should get the wingers.
I get the 90s wingers. Bernard Sal.
No, too early for him. But the.
Dominici.
No, too early for him.
All right. I'm trapped in the late 90s here.
What was? Who does Combo Barbero put in for that magnificent try at Twickenham?
Oh, Philippe Saint-André, obviously. Mm. Yeah. And then the other wing. The ones I always remember is when I was a kid, so that's Lagisquet, but that's...
No, you'll remember this
guy. The Bayonne Express and all that.
You remember this guy because we know his son very well now as well.
Oh, yeah, Emile Intermac.
Emile Intermac was on the right.
Of course. Of course, it's the World Cup year.
It was World Cup year, yeah.
Yeah.
And who was the... I think he might have been top scorer at the World Cup, actually, the inside centre. Goal kick in 12. Ended up at Harlequins for a
Richard
bit.
Richard Dorth.
Yeah, that was a bit later, I think.
I'm struggling.
Thierry Lacroix.
Yeah.
And the outside.
That's kind of, to me, in my memory, Thierry Lacroix and Christophe Lamazin are the same person. They're both interchangeable 10-12s.
The outside centre is only one person because he is an absolute legend.
Philippe Sella. And then the 15.
The fullback was a very good fullback, actually. And I don't know how many caps he got, but he was.
Jean-Baptiste Lafond.
It was not Jean-Baptiste Lafond. Nope. Jean-Luc Sadonnet.
All right. Yeah. He was one of those who was interchangeable on the wing as well.
Was he? I don't remember. I always remember him playing fullback, but yeah.
Maybe.
There you have it. Beautiful. What a wonderful way to end.
I have to say, I'm very disappointed in Yestin's effort in this Rothmans thing.
Yeah, I thought it would be all over this, but I think we're going to need the 84-85 version in order to get the true best out of Yestin when he's regaling us with stories of Byron Mugford and the likes.
And his NME era. So
That's it. Maybe we need the NME annual from this era in time.
Yeah. Okay, that's a long pod.
It is. 1 hour and 20 minutes, mate. Thank you very much. Oof. Boom. Thank you to Murph. Thank you to Yestin, who wisely got out before we started doing that. Thank you if you're listening at this point in time. That's a seriously good effort. And as always, a thanks to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. If you want to get some top quality coffee to keep you awake during these podcasts, you can do that by going to socoffeetrades.co.uk. Right, we'll be back to chat rugby with you next week. Thanks for listening. Podcast Network.